Fishing and farming both involve lots of hard work, quite a bit of risk, and a healthy share of good luck to bring the harvest to market. Both industries are comprised of an aging workforce, and national efforts are underway to try to attract more young people. For Alaska, maritime jobs make up the largest private employment sector, and there's big interest in local agriculture for healthy food options and the jobs that farming creates. How to ensure a robust workforce into the future for fishing and farming in the state is our discussion today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek. It makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello. Thank you for joining us today for Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and today we're talking about fishing and farming. Fishermen and farmers have a lot in common. It takes a strong work ethic along with a strong back for both careers. It means hard work and long hours battling bad weather, working with expensive and dangerous equipment, and often an unskilled or underskilled assistant workforce, all to take a gamble on making enough money from year to year to cover expenses and hope for a bit of profit. Did I mention that it's hard work? So with that set up, how tough is it to convince young people that they should risk their fingers, limbs, backs, and knees to do this work? That's going to be our conversation today. And joining me to talk over both industries is Paula Cullenberg. Paula is the director of the Alaska Sea Grant Program and co-author of a study called The Graying of the Fleet. Good morning, Paula.
Good morning, Laurie.
Also in the studio is Kelly Harrell. Kelly is the director of the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for being here. And Severin Fleming, is that right? Good morning, Severin. Severin is with, she's a founder of an organization called The Greenhorns. And they're focused on the future of farming. So I, from personal history, I know more about farming, having been the co-owner of a dairy operation in Wisconsin years ago and working in the past on several ranches. But I want to start first with the fishing industry, since that represents such a large part of the Alaska economy. Before we launch into that, I also want to let people know that you can join our conversation today. There's lots of fishing folks in Alaska, of course, and growing numbers of people interested in agriculture. So join us for today's discussion. If you have questions or comments about both industries, 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide, 1-800-478-8255. In the Anchorage area, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Paula, let's start with the study that is currently underway. What prompted this graying of the fleet research, and what did you find so far? I know it's not done.
Yeah, thanks, Laurie. Yeah, we're about halfway through this project, and you know, the graying of the fleet term basically came from Petersburg about a decade ago when a number of community members, fishermen, bankers, business owners really realized that there were aging fishermen in the Petersburg community, and that any time a fishing operation closed and they moved away or the permit was sold outside of Petersburg, that was basically a small business that was lost to that community and had, you know, far-ranging economic impacts. And I think the graying of the fleet is caught on as a result of that. And actually, if you look at excuse me, if you look at all of the maritime occupations in the state, you know, we estimate about 30,000 commercial fishermen and crew members in Alaska, about 25,000 people working in the seafood processing industry. But also at the research and management level, Fish and Game employs about 1,800 people. Marine transportation, the Marine Highway System employs another 1,700 folks around the state. There's all kinds of jobs, and we hear this graying of the fleet comment across the whole sector that, you know, people are getting older, they're leaving the occupations, and how do we encourage the next generation to consider that occupation? I think it's actually a national demographic. The boomers are all getting older. There's lots of us, and who's going to take their place? So this research project is funded by Alaska Sea Grant and the North Pacific Research Board. And our intent is to really look at two regions in the state, Kodiak region, including the smaller communities, and Bristol Bay, including some of those small communities, and try and figure out what young people perceive as the future in the fishing industry and whether there are any kinds of barriers that we might be able to influence at this point to keep that trend from going down as it has been. So
I know that the maritime industry itself encompasses a lot of what you just discussed, not just fishing, but the marine transportation and seafood and fish processing organizations. But let's kind of define what we mean by commercial fishing. That can be a very large vessel. It can also be quite small family operation. So how is there a way to sort of define what we mean by commercial fishing?
Well, I think, you know, there are a lot of fishermen in the state. So 30,000 fishermen, they fish, like you said, big boats, small boats. I think salmon permeates it all from the south to the north. That's really the small boat fishery, and the state limited entry permits are primarily salmon, herring, a few cod, et cetera. But when you look at the salmon industry per se, that's really the local family fishery traditionally. And then halibut, I think, and black cod are others that are big fisheries in Alaska.
And Kelly, maybe you want to jump in here too. Let's talk about what the revenue numbers are in the fishing industry and then in the larger sector of the maritime industry in the state. First, the commercial fishing revenue.
Well, I'll toss it back to Paula for the maritime industry revenue, I think, but the numbers from 2012 from a report NOAA puts out showed Alaska harvested about $2 billion and the ex-vessel value of fisheries was about $1.7, so almost $2 billion. So that means we're the top seafood producer in the U.S. That's about more than 55% of the total U.S. domestic seafood production, and it's more than four times than the next largest seafood producing state in the U.S. So we are certainly a force when it comes to harvesting wild seafood and providing it to the country and the world. As you mentioned earlier, it's our number one private sector and employer in Alaska. And in a lot of our rural coastal communities, it's one of the only opportunities for cash income for employment. So that's why it's really critical that we make sure that when it comes to the future of our communities, that young people, if they, you know, there's a lot of choices that goes into what being a fisherman or not, but that opportunity is there for them. So not everybody's going to choose that path, but making sure the opportunity exists. And what we're looking at is how do you build those support networks? How do you bring about change in the policy arena and the marketplace to actually make it more appealing for young fishermen who do want to be in the fishing industry?
If you're just joining us, we're talking today on Talk of Alaska about the future of fishing and agriculture farming in Alaska and looking at what the numbers are and what some of the plans are going forward. Paula, the larger maritime industry, give us some of those numbers.
Yeah, as Kelly said, I think one thing that's interesting is that all of these maritime sector jobs, whether they're research or marine transportation or marine freight or seafood processing or commercial fishing or shellfish farming, really add up to the largest private employer in the state of Alaska by far. And we estimated And I think it's a low estimate, about 70,000 jobs in this state. So when you're in a state of 650,000 people and you have 70,000 jobs related to the marine or coastal environment, that's significant. And I think everybody on the radio listening, if you think about all of the jobs that you can name in your community or in your region related to the coastal environment, it's very varied and it's very significant. So in terms of commercial fishermen, what we've been seeing is that the average age of commercial fishermen in our state right now is 50, and that is grown by about a decade since the 1980s. And so that's an indicator that that those fishermen are getting close to retirement, and they are not being replaced by people at a younger age. And of course, that's, as Kelly said, that's a significant concern when you have communities that are so dependent, their economy is so dependent on the harvesting of those natural resources.
Mm-hmm. Fishing and farming is our discussion today on Talk of Alaska. You can join us. Are you a commercial fisherman? Maybe you're in the graying part of the fleet, or maybe you're in the younger demographic and just getting started, or you're perhaps a small farmer or thinking about getting into farming here in Alaska. You can join our conversation, 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255, or locally 550-8422 in Anchorage, 550-8422. Email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. Severin, I don't want to leave you out of this conversation. We'll get to farming in just a second. I just have a couple more questions here on the fishing side of things. The demographics by gender, how many women are in the mix here? I was looking at some numbers from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and women account for only about 14% of commercial fishermen, both skippers and crew, and about one-third of processing workers. What's known about these numbers, why they're not actually higher? Women are tough and smart and can certainly work hard. Why aren't more choosing this path? Is there much known about that? I see some puzzled looks here
my
guests.
Yes, I think definitely women are strong and tough, and many women around the state are involved in commercial fisheries. And probably 14% may be an accurate number. It's probably higher than many other places in the country in terms of commercial fishermen. The place where you do see women in this maritime sector in our state is certainly in science and management. The graduate student population in the fisheries program is now well over 50% women. There are women in all other facets of the maritime industry, seafood processing, management, et cetera, across the state. So maybe it's not as high as it could be in harvesting, but I think it is. There is definitely a growing population of women involved in the industries.
Paula? Or I'm sorry, Kelly, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I was just going to add, there was a great article in Glamour magazine actually recently that was about the
commercial fisher women.
Yes, it was about profiled several very fabulous commercial fisherwomen amongst the ranks here in Alaska, and the a quote from Claire Neaton, I think from the Salmon Sisters of Homer, was that it's a small but strong pocket of women, and I think that defines it pretty well. And they are doing quite a bit when it comes to innovation in the industry, where the direct marketing and Drifter's Fish out of Cordova, Nellie Hand runs that, and they're doing really neat things and taking on leadership roles in the industry to try and innovate and collaborate. So I think it is important to recognize what our young fisher women are doing, and they're taking on leadership roles in the policy arena. I know at the Young Fishermen Summit.
Yeah, I was just going to mention, Alaska Sea Grant every other year does the Alaska Young Fishermen Summit, which is designed for young new fishermen in the 20 to 40 age range, and we usually have about 75 fishermen from around the state, and we'll do the next one in January in Juneau, and a good population of that group has always been women, so I think it's an up-and-coming thing that's happening with the next generation.
A small but strong pocket of women. I like that, strong being the operative word there for sure.
Yes.
Limited entry rationalization programs changed who can take part in the different commercial fisheries. How has that impacted who's able to get into the business today as opposed to 30 or 40 years ago? Paula?
Yeah, that's a That's a big issue of concern. It's something that we're definitely looking at in the graying of the fleet study. And the number of, if you look at fishing communities across our state, the number of limited entry holders, permit holders who are under 40 has declined significantly, particularly in the smaller communities, but even in a hub community like Dillingham or Kodiak, the number of permit holders under 40 has decreased by maybe 50%, 75% in communities across the state. And I think that's a significant public policy issue. It was actually one of the five recommendations of the governor's transition team that looked at fisheries, what we could do to help the state. So it is a significant issue. And yeah, it costs a lot of money to buy a limited entry permit. Now, if you want to buy a permit, you need to buy a boat, you need to buy gear. You know, in Bristol Bay right now is a drift fisherman that can cost you $500,000, and that's not unusual around the state. So, you know, there are a few ways to find the capital for that. There's a state fishing loan program. Commercial Fishing and Agriculture Bank will loan on a permit. But it's a big risk. It's a big bite to take when you're a young person to enter that kind of debt and to look at variability in prices and fishing returns and climate change. You know, it's a concern, definitely.
Is it primarily the price that is keeping younger people out? Is that the big prohibition?
Well, that's one of the main things we're looking at, the graying the fleet. We are we're interviewing commercial fishermen. We're interviewing new young commercial fishermen, and we're surveying high school and middle school students. And certainly the privatization that leads to the high cost of entry is one significant piece. But there's also other things about related to, you know, whether or not your family is involved, whether or not you have access to learning how to fish and you know, or just know how to do the operations, whether or not you can accommodate another job as well as fishing, if fishing is only a seasonal occupation. Mm-hmm. So I think all of those are going through young people's minds.
1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. If you're part of the fishing industry or benefit from it and want to talk about why it's important, or if you're in agriculture or thinking about it, today's a good day to call in and get your questions answered about what you may need to know about getting into either one of these industries. Also locally, 550-8422 is the number, or you can email us talk@alaskapublic.org. We're talking about fishing and farming and the graying of the fleet today. And we're going to go to the phones now. Joel is in Sitka. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Lori.
Thanks for calling in. Did you have a question or a comment?
No, a little bit of a comment. So, you know, you guys had mentioned, and Paul had mentioned, the grain of the fleet, and I teach fisheries classes in the fisheries technology program down here, and we're seeing the same thing, both not only in fisheries management, but also in salmon enhancement around the state of Alaska. We've got a lot of hatcheries in the state, and those folks are telling us that they're seeing very similar things, and some of the things that we're trying to do in our program to try and expand, you know, sort of the net that we're casting to try and recruit students in is offer classes, you know, via distance. We have a new program where we're putting classes on iPads now and taking field classes all around the state and in hub communities. And so, you know, I think that, you know, everybody across the sectors are seeing this grain of the fleet, and we're trying to do some innovative things, as a lot of other people in the industry are, to try and reach out to some of those students. But it's definitely a common problem.
Well, thank you, Joel, for calling in and raising those issues and what you guys are working on in Southeast. Going back to the expense and how that's connected to this, my big brother was a commercial fisherman for about 34 or 35 years out of Wrangell. Just sold his boat recently, has two grown sons. They decided they didn't want to go into fishing. They went to college and went into other fields. But he and I were talking the other day, and he said that, you know, he sold his boat, but when he started all those decades ago, he said you could start with a $15 hand troll permit and some funky little boat and just go out there and start fishing. And that's how he got started. Now he said, you know, to get in, even at his level of fishing, it's going to be a $200,000 to $400,000 investment. Is this because of quotas, IFQs, and the rationalization, limited entry, or is that only part of the picture? And are there things in place? Joel mentioned studies that they're doing and what they're working on in his region. Are there programs in place to sort of help people to get in and take off in this industry when you don't have $500,000?
Well, one point that you mentioned too, Laurie, this feeling your brother wanted to retire and get out of fishing, and I think that is also a big question for older commercial fishermen in the state, and it's a quandary. I mean, do you sell your entire operation to the highest bidder for the highest dollar so that you can enjoy your retirement, or is there a way that you can sell it to someone in your community, a younger person, maybe a crew member, and what kind of risk do you take on when you do that? And I think that's an area that we as a state could look at more significantly. We don't set up a good process so that an older fisherman who wants to retire can somehow work with a younger person from that region or from that community or fishery to enable them to move into it slowly but surely. And sometimes it's an all-or-nothing thing. You either have to sell it or you don't. And it's asking a lot for an individual to give up a high-dollar opportunity for a good retirement so that they can support the next generation. So what can we do to accommodate that? I think that's a kind of question that could be looked at in terms of public policy. Right now, if you buy a salmon limited entry permit, you either own it or you don't. You can't lease it. You can't buy it over time. And that adds a level of risk that maybe isn't appropriate. I know in some parts of the country, they have set up community permit banks, which allows a community to hold a number of permits and maybe lease them instead of sell them outright. And that might be something to look at for the state.
Are banks squeamish about loaning money for these types of operations? My oldest son lives in Sitka. And he's been paying on a boat for a few years now. He's buying a small boat, and he goes out with someone who has a permit, and he also has a hand troll permit. But he's been making payments to the vessel owner, and when he does catch fish, a percentage of that cash goes to the owner as well. But I'm wondering if you're a young person with a setup like that where you're sort of on a land contract for the vessel itself, is a bank going to be willing to say, sure, we'll loan you the money for a commercial permit? What's the thinking along those lines? Kelly, are there banks out there?
There are banks out there that are do more business, I think, when it comes to commercial fishing lending. There's also the CFAB, the Commercial Fishing Agricultural Bank, that does lending specifically in the fishing industry. Some of the community development quota groups have their own loan programs. For instance, the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation has a loan program specifically for the region's residents. And then the state also has some loan programs for things like engine upgrades, the purchase of vessels. So there are opportunities out there, and they may not be advertised perhaps as well as they could be, but I think a lot of it, as Paul mentioned earlier, and you mentioned about making the decision to take that risk and having a good business plan in place and being diversified and understanding how you're going to make those payments in age of uncertainty. So Paula mentioned some good things that are happening around other parts of the country, and we are starting to look out here in Alaska. Like how can we anchor quota and access to fisheries in communities? So when somebody decides to sell, maybe there's not a buyer in that community who has that level of capital, but maybe there's another type of entity that can hold that quota or hold the permit and keep it in the community. And there are places in Maine, Maine's lobster program, they do not allow lobster permits to be bought and sold. So you can fish that permit if you get in line and you go. They have an apprenticeship program. It's really unique. But you can't sell that lobster permit once you're done fishing. It goes back, and if you're in the queue and you're next in line, then you can get that permit. And they also have certain regions where island regions that are meant to help sustain the health of island communities. So if you want that to go fish in that region, you have to live there year round. So there are some pretty neat things being done in other parts of the country. Here in Southeast, there's the Alaska Sustainable Fisheries Trust that has also been set up to help purchase specifically halibut and sable fish quota, and then lease that out to local regional residents to help keep access within communities. There is some hope, and there are some innovative things that we can do when it comes to financing specifically and ownership structures.
Well, those are really interesting programs. The idea of the lobster fishermen holding those permits and then letting people have access to them, that's a unique idea, and we'll see how those programs might, similar programs might grow here in Alaska. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Norman is in Haines, and I think Norman is a graying fisherman. Hello, Norman.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
And I am a graying fisherman. At 55, I got in at 23. Followed a woman to Alaska. State wasn't big enough for the both of us, so I went fishing. Short story.
And do you plan to stay in for quite a while yet, or what's your future look like?
I've been 32 years now, and for a guy who doesn't like being cold, wet, and lonely, I picked a hell of a lifestyle, but I stuck with it. I spent one inheritance on engines. I got creative in financing. I chased people down when someone died in a family and got a hold of their permit and leased it. I ran boats for 2 years, and after a total of 4 years, I owned a boat and permit, state loan, CFAB loan. In the 80s, peak of the permits at the time, they were skyrocketing. I bought myself a lifestyle, and I've been in it ever since. And when I see something come available, I try and go after it if it's something I'd like, especially halibut quotas, consolidating. So I've just been reinvesting in multiple fisheries over the years. So now I have 5 different permits that I can fish shrimp, crab, halibut, gillnet, salmon here based in Southeast. And I haven't worked on an exit strategy yet.
So it sounds like you stay very busy, first of all, but also are you able to, this is the only path that you have right now for a livelihood. You don't have to have another job in off seasons, how does that work for you as far as making your living?
Fishing is over 90-95% of my income over the years. I have had to work at marinas, building docks, doing boat building, drywall. When I was starting out in the 80s, I'd have to work all winter just so I could fish. Seasons weren't that good. Prices crashing on fish. I made it work like a lot of guys did, and we're still in it. I was relatively young when I started, I thought, 20-some years. I thought I'd be out in 10 years and have a condo in Seattle and a cabin in the woods in Alaska, but that didn't happen, and here I'm still at it. I got a dive fishery for sea cucumbers where you crawl around the seafloor and chase worms going off next week. So I'm still pretty active, and, fishing is, you need a skill set for fishing, and it involves plumbing, electrical, boat building, navigating, reading maps, working with people, building alliances, working with people you don't like. When they say you can't fish, you got to figure another plan. You have to be able to be very flexible. It's not like a lot of other issues, more like farming. You take what you get and you make it work.
Mm-hmm.
Norman, if I could just say, first of all, that was just an awesome explanation of what the fishing lifestyle is.
Absolutely.
And a couple of things that you mentioned. The only thing I didn't like is the whole graying thing, since you're younger than I am. But the two things that Norman mentioned that struck home with me from what we've seen. One is this idea of diversification. And, you know, that's another important issue, I think, for our state to look at. You know, is the privatization and limited entry systems that were put in place, are they still able to accommodate a fisherman like Norman to be able to diversify so that he can really be a fisherman and go easily from one fishery into the next? So we want to make sure that to the extent possible, we can help make that happen. And then, of course, secondly, that whole thing about lifestyle is something that, you know, we've seen for decades, and prices go up and prices go down, and fishermen just stay in it because they really love it. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the call, Norman. I was thinking about my big brother again when Norman was talking about what he had to do in the wintertime. My brother worked at the local hardware store in Wrangell and helped install furnaces and things like that in the winter when he wasn't fishing, but it was all geared toward, you know, getting ready for the next season. We are talking today on Talk of Alaska about fishing, and we're going to move into farming also when we come back from a short break as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Rural CAP commemorates 50 years of delivering early childhood education programs like Head Start and Parents as Teachers. Signature housing programs, including weatherization, self-help housing, and permanent affordable housing, make a difference in our communities. AmeriCorps members and elder mentors have positive impacts to education, health, and the environment. Learn more at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing fishing and farming today. And you can join our conversation if you'd like. We've had a couple great calls. Love some more. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 1-800-478-8255. Or in the Anchorage area, you can reach us at 550-8422. 550-8422 or email talk@alaskapublic.org. I want us to move into the farming world now, something that I'm more familiar with. Having grown up with farming families on both sides of my parents and also myself, I was a dairy farmer on a 200-acre operation for a number of years, and then also worked on some beef and horse ranches in Wyoming and North Dakota many years ago in other iterations of my life. But let's talk about farming now. Severin Fleming is with us, and she is the founder, or one of the founders, of the Greenhorns. It's an advocacy group for young farmers getting into the business. And Kelly, I know that you had some thoughts about how the two kind of come together. So what did you want to say in that regard?
Yeah, so I met Severin several years ago and actually heard her first on APRN on Bioneers Radio talking about the graying of the farm, and was just struck by the similarities between what was happening here in Alaska with our young fishermen and what she was talking about when it came to the graying of the farm. So here in Alaska, the average age of an Alaskan farmer is 56, so a little bit older than our fishermen, actually, and just the lack of new entrants that are entering into both fishing and farming, the high cost of entry when it comes to also farmland equipment, and when it comes to boats, permits and quota, and also the roles that farmers and fishermen both play as stewards of our land and water. And that's something we really focus on at the Alaska Marine Conservation Council when it comes to community-based fishermen, and trying to ensure that they're sustained in those stewardship roles. So we've been collaborating extensively with other food groups and in Alaska. I'm on the Alaska Food Policy Council board also, and we came across the Greenhorns, and they are doing really great things. We've been helping to organize this Alaska tour for Severin. She was in Homer earlier this weekend for the Homer Halibut Fest and in Kenai, and she's got a few other stops that we'll talk about. But we helped create the Alaska Young Fishermen's Network, which is an emerging network to help young fishermen come together and collaborate and learn from each other and innovate together and be strong and resilient and find that way forward in a really challenging industry. So we've been looking at the greenhorns as a model for what can be done. So excited to have Severin talk more about what some of that great stuff is.
Yeah, Severin, so you're sort of on the greenhorn rock tour of Alaska, traveling around. What Give us a bit of a rundown of what greenhorns is, first of all.
Sure. So as Kelly mentioned, as we're all kind of aware, the average age of the American farmer is actually older even. It's 58 years old. About 70% of American farmland is owned by people over 65. So we have similarly an issue of recruitment, retirement, attrition, and new entry. And those are kind of convergent issues and very much to do with the character of the economy in agriculture. Getting in is really hard. Operating, you know, as you know from dairy, is very challenging to get another income off the same land when the price of milk is so volatile and so low. So the people that we're in touch with the greenhorns, are new entrants into agriculture, often entering agriculture with reform on their minds, trying to build a new economy or a better economy in agriculture, especially around sustainable practices, but also in terms of local wealth creation, a greater diversity in terms of what we're producing, treating the soil with a bit more care as it's become imperiled by our farming practices over the last 150 years. And the mission of greenhorns, of course, is to provide kind of cultural infrastructure and encouragement. Our mission is to recruit, promote, and support the incoming generation of agrarians. And we have a very excited and highly motivated entering generation called the rising generation in agriculture, especially in states where local food and organic food have a big marketplace. So especially in places where the mentorship of the previous generation and the appetite within the marketplace allow this incoming generation to start farm businesses and to be adequately prosperous to survive.
So tell us about, you said that there's a new wave, a new generation of people wanting to get into the agrarian industry and into farming. Are the majority of them coming from outside traditional farm families, or what's the mix, your demographics? Who's coming in and how much experience do they have when they come in?
So it is a big mix, and we do have in the beginning farmer and rancher development programs, which are part of the USDA. We have classes being offered across the country in practical skills including business skills, as well as cultivation and all of the kind of vocational training that we know to be a common need between farmers and fisher people. Those USDA programs were funded because Secretary Vilsack, who's the Secretary of Agriculture, said we need 100,000 new growers. And so that beginning farmer and rancher development program was set up in order to support training, access to capital, access to business skills, and helping young people navigate their career trajectory into this sector. So the people who are coming in, some of them with farm backgrounds, trying to figure out how to retool their parents' business to be able to sustain another generation. Sometimes moving, for instance, from commodity liquid milk production into making yogurt. We have a whole yogurt boom now going on in New York State, and similarly with cheese and other value-added milk products in Vermont. And then we have a lot of women also entering. And actually, in the state of Vermont, the fastest growing demographic in agriculture is women under 25.
Wow.
In the state of Maine, you have a 40% increase in farmers under 35 in the last census period. So we do see you know, it is statistically relevant what's happening, and very encouraging to those in the elder generation to see this new influx of energy and motivation and collaboration and team spirit that, of course, is made necessary by the economic challenge. So it's that, I think that's the kind of main mission I'm on in coming to visit the Fisher people here, is to express how fluid and sharing this community of young farmers are among each other in understanding our needs, in sharing tactics, in sharing capital, in sharing buildings, in synergizing between our businesses around distribution and value add in order to make it in a challenging world.
Well, it's interesting. I hadn't thought before about the really very clear connections between the health of both farming and fishing. The practices on land have great impact on waterways and how fisheries can stay healthy or not. So there is a big connection between fishermen and farmers, and I think it's great that your organization is working to sort of look at both sides of this and how people can sort of come together. 1-800-478-8255 is the number if you have a question for, we have some experts here today, people on fishing and farming. If you have questions about how to get in or what you need to know, this is the place to call. 1-800-478-8255 or in the Anchorage area, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Severin, tell us about the Farmland Commons and the Agrarian Trust. Are the two the same thing, or tell us about what those are?
Sure. So as we're looking at this transfer of ownership, you guys have quota. We farm with land. So we have a lot of land that will be undergoing a transition of ownership. And that's just because of demographics. You know, it's not their fault that they're gray-haired. They just, they got that way. And the question is, who will manage that land moving forward? And under what terms? And will that land be used for commodities, for export, for corn and soy and wheat to be spread out on a global market? Or will that land be used for the local community to provide better healthy food in schools and hospitals? Will we have good land stewardship, of course, for our waterways and the marine ecosystems that water flows into? It's a pretty high stakes question. And we'd like to provoke that question being asked at a higher level. So I think we've seen great traction in understanding that we need to get new generation of growers on the land. And I think now the question is, how do we mobilize capital such that we can keep that land under the control of family farmers and for the benefit of the communities in which they farm? So one of the kind of tactics that's been really useful within the young farmer movement has been community finance. And community finance and community-supported agriculture. So both of those are new economic forms that try to share the risk that's inherent in any natural or ecosystem-based business, the weather, of course, which is changing faster than ever, and spreading that risk out to all the users. So with the community-supported agriculture program, which you may be familiar with, the farmer is selling shares of the harvest ahead of planting, and the customers are buying their vegetables before the season starts. And the advantage is to both parties. It's kind of like a truce between the producer and the consumer. The consumer gets great, reliable, fresh, delightful weekly vegetables and a much better diet and a good value, and the farmer has a security of knowing they can enter that season and all the capital required to enter that season.
And the customer doesn't have to do the weeding.
Right. And so similarly, for people who live in a place connected to a watershed, connected to a land base, to be co-stewards of that watershed, of that land base, and recognizing the tremendous benefits, the local wealth creation, the local job creation, the habitat for all the other creatures on the land besides the farm animals, and make sure that we have that land base to support us. So a lot of our work with Agrarian Trust is working to create the structures that allow community investment in farmland. and community ownership of farmland.
The idea of the community supported, the CSAs, there's also fishermen that are doing similar things, community supported fishing, where people are selling fishing futures. And this idea of going directly from fishermen and from farmers right to consumers seems to be growing in popularity. Are you seeing a lot of that uptick in fishing, Paula and Kelly, where fishermen, fishing families maybe are saying, hey, buy directly from us instead of from someplace else?
There is quite a bit, actually. And at the Alaska Marine Conservation Council, we have a community-supported fishery, and we kind of play a broker role in the middle between community-based fishermen and local processors and consumers in Anchorage and now in Fairbanks and the Kenai Peninsula area. But the Salmon Sisters, they're doing a direct-to-consumer program. Drifter's Fish out of Cordova, Iliamna Fish Company, Sitka Salmon Shares started in Sitka, and now they're selling in the Midwest. There are the Alaska Sustainable Fisheries Trust has Alaskan's Own, which was the first CSF, as they call it, in Alaska. So there are some new models for direct marketing and community-supported fisheries cropping up in Alaska. They're challenging for a number of reasons, and that's something we're interested in at the Alaska Marine Conservation Council, is how to help build these business models, how to support a food infrastructure and a food system where our fishermen are more connected to consumers in the marketplace, to chefs, and get chefs and restaurants in Alaska asking hard questions about where their fish came from and if these are from local community-based fishermen. And we think that like you were saying, co-stewards sever in between consumers of seafood and our harvesters is something that's really important, and it's going to be more important as we face more challenges moving forward in our marine ecosystems with climate change and ocean acidification and other types of environmental threats. We need people who eat seafood to participate in the future health of our fisheries.
And Severin, going back to this idea of protection and asking questions, people asking questions, and the idea of the community sponsoring farming initiatives, there's an email question here from a listener in Palmer. Carrie says that her parents are farmers in Palmer, as were her grandparents. And she said that she and her husband would love to take over the farm as they age. But aside from the difficulty of making a living, she says the encroachment of town is a problem. The borough took a bunch of land to build Bogard Road, she said, supposedly compensating them for it. But how do you compensate for the loss of revenue from working farmland? And how do we trust that there is a future to farming within the borough? She's afraid that the future doesn't look that promising. So can you expand a little bit about what some communities are doing in that regard when you're seeing the valley is growing at a tremendous rate? So a lot of people are moving out there. And I remember my mom, who grew up, she was a farmer too, and grew up in a farming family, saying when she would see new housing developments going in, she'd say, where are we going to grow corn if these housing plots are all developed in farm fields? So What's the current thinking about how to look at that development versus protecting farmland, Severin?
If only the farmland could speak for itself. but we have to speak for our farmland. And, you know, in the United States, we lose about 3 acres of farmland a minute. We are encroaching on a really rapid scale onto our farmland. And in many cases, our farmland policy is kind of based in 1840. We think we've got a whole bunch of land that we're, you know, we came as a poor people to a land that we considered empty and full of wealth. And we haven't totally reorganized our conception as a nation. So I think that's one of the major paradigm shifts that this coming century imposes on us, and particularly as we face threats to our crops as well as to our fisheries because of a changing climate. You know, it's sometimes the mental habits of those of the gray end of our producers are it's hard for them to accept the new patterns. And I think entering generation, we're really very aware of the threats and really oriented towards a more resilient and more diverse kind of farming, because we perceive that threat as very immediate and extreme, actually. So some of the ways that we can work to support ourselves as a movement and as a sector in farming is to build better farms and build farms that are more diverse. And that also means getting accustomed to a broader set of equipment, a broader set of crops, having integrated with animals and vegetables and pasture systems, tree crop systems, hedgerows, having controlled environment growing. I know in Alaska you guys are really into these greenhouses, these hoop houses made possible by USDA grants. And there is increasingly research out there to support us in modifying our growing systems for the climate that's coming. So I basically would encourage those who are thinking in terms of entering this sector to really to recognize that there's an opportunity in thinking ahead.
I was going to add, when it comes to the Valley in particular, the Alaska Farmland Trust is the entity that's specifically set up, and that is their mission, to protect that really important farmland in the Mat-Su Valley, also in other parts of the state, in the Kenai Peninsula, that's being encroached on by various other uses. And I would encourage anybody who goes to the farmers markets like I do, who loves the diversity of things that are available there, to find out more about what it takes to keep the farmland we need in the state growing food for our community.
So maybe Carrie should get in touch with the Farmland Trust and talk to those folks about the security of land in the valley going forward.
Definitely.
Might be a good place for her to start. Okay, we're talking about fishing and farming, and we will continue this conversation as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. October 6th is REAA Election Day. Polls are open 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. You'll be voting for REAA school board candidates. When you go to vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the list or you don't have ID, you may vote a question ballot. The question ballot updates your voter registration. If you need language or other assistance while voting, ask the election board or bring somebody to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about fishing and farming. I was just trying to quickly look at some emails while we were taking that short break, and a couple of them look very interesting, but wow, were they long, so we're not going to be able to read those. But there was one author of an email who had some very harsh things to say about rationalization, and that the reason that it's hard for people that don't have big financial means to get in is because of that. Do either of you want to respond to that idea of why allocations were put in place, why rationalization was put in place in the first place, and how that's either added to this situation where it takes a lot more money? Clearly it has made it a situation where it takes a lot more money to get in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I there's no question that that's been one of the collateral effects of privatization. But if you look at the history of limited entry, which was 1975, 1976, that certainly was a social experiment in the salmon industry to try and keep control of the harvest and to make sure as many people as possible could be involved in that industry. And one of the more important things that came out of limited entry was this concept of owner on board. So you actually can't be a salmon limited entry permit holder sitting at home in your living room. You actually have to be on the boat catching the fish. And that's been something, I think, that's been a model for permit authorizations all across the country.
Let's go back to the phones just for a moment in our final few minutes here. Bill is in Kenai. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Do you have a question or a comment?
No, I had a comment. Great show, interesting topic. You were asking about ideas for ways that a fisherman wanting to get out could help one getting in, and one would be to get some federal modification of the Capital Construction Fund, and fishermen know that that's a fund started in the 50s and 60s by Congress to ostensibly modernize the American fishing fleet that lets you take before tax dollars and put them away for a rainy day and gain whatever interest on that investment vehicle and not pay tax on it until you put the new boat or whatever in service. But when you get into that program, as many of us did in the 70s and 80s, your fishery can change over time. Your objectives can change over time. Then you approach to retirement. You've got money in that program, and the penalties are really forbidding to get out of it sweetly, if you may. You might lose 90% of your capital to penalties from the federal government and the IRS if you agree that you don't want to build that boat that you told them that you were saving for 25 years ago. And there's a lot of latitude in that program. One way to offer relief would be for the feds to modify that program. And this issue has been in Senator Murkowski's office, and I think it was even in her father's office before that. I used to be involved in fish politics. I try to keep my distance anymore, but this was an issue amongst California, Oregon, Washington, and Alaskan fishing organizations. And you take that money, and instead of getting penalized, you roll it into your retirement account so you can help yourself over your retirement. Then in exchange for that, and this is done in the corporate world with the governments and Exxon or Microsoft and that, you want to build a factory in our place, we're going to give you all these tax credits. So now I've gotten that advantage of taking my money out of the Capital Construction Fund with no penalty, and I can put it into my retirement so I can fund myself for my retirement. Hmm. In exchange, I consider selling my boat and permit to a young guy, and I serve as the bank. Mm-hmm. I take more risk. I don't have the security with that vehicle going into my retirement, but I'm padded on the other side. Now, not everybody has a CCF, but there are plenty of them out there, and this is the exact situation that we're in right now. And if you don't have something like that, you get into a situation where you're essentially almost throwing good money after bad. If you're getting ready to retire and your particular fishery is not booming, it may not justify you putting that sort of investment in it in order to avoid the penalties, but still fulfill your CCF agreement with the government.
So. Okay. Well, thank you, Bill. I hate to cut you off. This is a really fascinating line of discussion, but we only have a minute left. So in that last minute, thank you so much for the call. And Severin, where else are you going to be that people can connect with you while you're in Alaska here?
I'm going to Palmer tonight.
Yeah, you'll be at the UAF Experimental Farm in Palmer tonight.
Okay.
And then tomorrow, you'll be back here on the APU campus at the Farmers Market there and talking
Great.
At 7 p.m. And then on Thursday at the Beartooth, we're showing the Greenhorns documentary film at 3 p.m. So make sure to join those events.
And we will link to the Greenhorn site. We'll also link to the studies on the graying of the fleet. Thank you to my guests, Severin Fleming, Kelly Harrell, and Paula Cullenberg. Thanks to Dave Waldron, our engineer, and Josh Edge on phones. Next week, we'll be talking about prison reform.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. There is still time to start the Business Administration and Management program at Alaska Pacific University. Module 2 courses start on Wednesday, October 21st. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
These days, being into STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, doesn't make a girl a geek. It makes the world a better place. If you like numbers, nature, computers, and figuring out how the world really works, go to beanengineeralaska.com. You just might like what you learn. And it's not just for girls. This message on Alaska Public Media brought to you by ExxonMobil in Alaska.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.